I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Dave Eggers is a writer, editor, and publisher. His first book, a memoir titled A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius, was a Pulitzer finalist for general nonfiction. In 2024, he was awarded the Newbery Medal for the children's book The Eyes and the Impossible. Dozens of his books, fiction, nonfiction, books for children, and more, have been published in the 26 years since that first memoir. Dave Eggers is also the founder of the independent publishing house McSweeney's. His new novel, Contrapposto, touches on yet another important aspect of his life, art. This novel follows a friendship between Cricket and Olympia. Cricket is a talented and aspiring young artist with a knack for figure drawing, and Olympia is most interested in the business of art. We get to follow along as the two weave in and out of each other's lives for decades. I recently spoke with Dave Eggers about how his own background in art helped shape this book, and how these characters lived in his mind for 20 years. Here's our conversation. Let's start with the title. Can you talk to me about the title? Because according to Merriam-Webster, contrapposto is defined as a position of the depicted human body, as in late Renaissance painting and sculpture, in which twisting of the vertical axis results in hips, shoulders, and head turned in different directions. So how did you arrive at this title for the novel?
Well, it's a word I always loved since I was in art school myself. And then when you're trying to think of a title that might sort of allude to certain themes in the book and might be a little bit different and grab your attention, I see contrapposto as like a pose that's sort of imbalanced and yet balanced at the same time. So if you see Michelangelo's David, that's like the most famous contrapposto pose where he's leaning on one leg. It's very natural, but then at the same time, it's not perfectly balanced and not perfectly stable. And so the relationship between the two main characters, Olympia and Cricket, is that there's a balance to it, but it's quite imbalanced too, always. And so it's perfectly imbalanced throughout. And so I liked it as a title, and I also titled the book after finishing it, which is pretty rare for me. And the word is never mentioned in the book, which I love. I always love it when books don't include the title within, so that you're coming across this dread of like, oh, when are they going to mention the title in the book? I'm going to see if they did it well or not well. And so the one spoiler I will give to your listeners is that the title never is included, so you can relax.
Let's talk about, our two main characters. We meet Cricket and Olympia when they're young. I think Cricket's grandfather says he's almost 10 years old, if I remember right. And Olympia is like a year older or so. Why did you have them meet at this age?
Well, I've always thought about these two as lifelong friends. For the maybe 20 years I've been thinking about this book, I've always seen them as really covering most of their lives. And I wanted them to meet, just at the very first blush of sort of realizing, especially in Cricket's case, realizing that he's good at something, which in his case, he can draw. And they meet when she asks him or encourages him to deface a public play structure using sort of like a oversized Sharpie and his approximation of calligraphy. But I think that to really sort of underline the way that a lifelong friendship changes, but then really doesn't change in a lot of ways. If you were to go through how they act and interact with each other at the very beginning, and then at the end, there's a lot of commonalities. And I find that to be really true. Like most of my friends I've had since grade school, and here we are in our 50s, and I can't think of more than a few superficial ways that it's changed or that any of us have changed in the way we interact with each other. So I can still see the child in all of these friends of mine that were in our, fifth decade together. It's remarkable. And so I don't think I could have written this 20 years ago in my 30s, because I really wouldn't have believed how little changes. You go through all kinds of things together for sure, but in terms of how you see each other and the sort of the light in each other's eyes that you recognize from when you were 9 years old, it's exactly the same. So I wanted to start there. And then I think by the time we go through their lives together and, you know, it ends when they're in their 70s, I think that you know these characters inside and out. And for me writing it, I could write their dialogue in my sleep. Like I know exactly what they're going to say to each other at all times. And it was so, the dialogue in particular was so effortless in a way that I was, felt like I was just transcribing conversations that were going on without much of my own help. You know, it was really just about getting it down because they, it felt so, so fluid and so inevitable.
I guess this question is maybe asking about Olympia's character a bit, because early in the book, Cricket is reunited with Olympia for the first of many times, and she is known among her peers for claiming that she's the reincarnation of the French philosopher Albert Camus. So what is going on here? Talk to me about Olympia.
Well, I think we all know those people growing up that are just almost from another planet. They're so, Cricket is, you know, astounded by her intellect and her wit and her otherworldliness. And he's never heard of anybody claiming to be reincarnated versions of anyone, let alone Camus. And he's never heard of Camus. He's only 14 or something like that at the time, never been outside of Indiana. But I think that it was key to give her that kind of, like, she's insanely quick-witted, and she will sort of walk around the room and reference 19 different painters, philosophers, writers, novels that he's never heard of or read. And I think that she's a whirlwind of erudition and references, and he's enthralled by that because she sort of has all the keys and maps to the landscape that he wants to travel, which is the art world. And so that becomes kind of, you know, important in their dynamic forever, is that he has some talent as a draftsman and as a painter, but has no idea where to go or how to navigate that world. Whereas she, from the time when she's a teenager, from then on, she's incredibly comfortable with business side of the art world. And she knows exactly how to go places, do things, get things done, who to know, who to call. And he's utterly clueless in that way. And she's continually, desperately trying to pull him into that world and give him the map and help him through it and make him what she would see as a success. But he's stubbornly resistant all throughout because he never finds a comfortable sort of an equilibrium within that world and the many compromises that are attendant to it.
You know, I was fascinated by the canon of proportions. I'm so glad you went to art school. So can you explain this to us?
We've all seen in TV or cartoon or whatever, we've seen a picture of the art student with their arm out and their thumb up and they're squinting with one eye. And that is a, you know, a trope. But it's actually something that you learn really like first day of life drawing class. And that is what they're doing, is they're putting their thumb over the face of the model. And then that thumb becomes a unit of measurement. So then you say, well, how many heads is the body of this model? And then you go down and you count how many thumbs / heads the rest of the model's body is. And then you say how wide the shoulders of this model are, and you use the thumb again. So anyone can draw perfectly anatomically correct and photographically realistically given enough time and given just these canon of proportions. Like how many heads is the body? Well, usually about seven and a half, right? How many widths of the, you know, shoulders and waist, all of these things, they're just proportions. And so once you master that, you realize like, oh, you know, a certain level of academic drawing can be taught really to anyone if you have the patience and humility and work ethic to do it. Early on in art school, you know, an academy at least, you would do poses that are about, you might spend 8 to 9 hours on one pose, drawing one person in one pose. But at the end, it will look like a photograph, more or less, because you've spent all that time getting it right. It's not taught as much these days, but you can always, in any given city, I'm sure in Wichita, there's somebody that's still teaching academic life drawing. And it's something I recommend to anybody, because it's really astounding how you can achieve that level of accuracy and fidelity, but you just have to sort of put in the time. So I inserted some, you know, real and aspects of, you know, academic teaching, and hopefully not too much, but enough to know, like, oh, it's the same way that, you know, you might learn classical music. You know, you read music, you get the notes right, you get the tone right, you get the pacing right, all of those things. In the art world, it's not as rigid, and it's much rarer to learn this way these days, but it's still out there, and I think it's still really valuable, and I was really happy that I learned that way.
When Cricket was young, he learned about art, classical art, and the masters through reading books at the library. He took a drawing class in Chicago, after which he thought next he would have to go to Europe. And his art education was more closely aligned with that of the masters rather than, you know, like a university art program of this time, wasn't it? I mean, he wanted to apprentice and build frames and stretch canvases and the like, didn't he?
Yeah, it's, you know, he spends his lunch hours when he's working. He works at like a train station cafe, and he spends his lunch hours at the library. And when you go through the sort of, and you're reading about Rembrandt and you're reading about Zurbaran and Velázquez and, you know, all of these old masters, you definitely get the idea that this is the way that it has always been done, because it was done for centuries. At age 12 or 13 or 14, you'd be apprenticed to a master artist, and you'd learn from them and learn how to mix paint and learn how to draw and learn how to paint and learn how to glaze and all of these classical techniques. And pretty much in the 20th century, that all went away, 19th and 20th century. But in the 20th century, American art education changed drastically. And it became a part of the university system and then colleges, and then art schools were invented. And it strayed really far from that model. And it became, you know, at this stage, to get a four-year degree in, say, printmaking, it will cost you upwards of $400,000. And the chances of you sort of learning one-on-one with a, you know, established artist are pretty slim. You'll be in class, but you're not going to have that one-on-one, you know, time where you're learning through osmosis and you're helping another artist and you're doing so and you're learning all of that for free. And so I do think we're in a weird spot where I don't think an art education should cost anybody $400,000. Here in San Francisco, we just started something called Art and Water, which is going to be a free master's level program where 10 established artists will teach 20 aspiring artists, all sharing space together in an empty pier, now empty pier on the waterfront, Pier 29 here in San Francisco, and it'll all be free. So a bunch of friends and I sort of put together this program to sort of reinvent but really sort of remind ourselves of the old model, which was a free sharing of knowledge from, you know, master to apprentice.
You know, I was going to ask you about Art and Water because Cricket took a variety of art classes, first from a Romanian lady down the street and the evening class in Chicago and Carpenter's atelier-style instruction on the farm, and he even led an atelier in Paris. And so I wanted to ask a little bit about something you've just touched on, because when Cricket was in college, he met a man, a former art professor, who had strong feelings about how art schools are set up today, tearing each other down through critiques, and this man, Carpenter. Can you talk to me about his philosophy?
Well, he's been sort of run out of this school because he's a little bit of a dinosaur, and he believes in sort of old ways, and also believes in an atmosphere of mutual support. And there's a young, talented painter who has her work sort of shredded by professors and fellow students and graduate students all in a critique. You know, we call it a crit. And these still happen, and they've been happening for many decades now. I think it's, in most cases, a horrible, horrible thing to have 35 people all sitting there judging and, your work all at once and being attacked. I've never been through one, but I've heard of these for years and decades. And it seems to me just the very worst way to get feedback from people is 30 people at once. And also so many people just sort of building on what somebody else said and coming up with something to say to impress a peer or colleague instead of what really should be done, which is, you know, private feedback one-on-one from your peers and professors in a kind and supportive setting, let's say. But this is a worst-case scenario represented in this crit in the book, which is they really feel like to succeed themselves, these fellow students have to tear down their peers. And this hyper-competitive kind of cannibalistic atmosphere is really not good for anybody. And Carpenter makes the point that there hasn't ever been a successful artist that ever emerged from that particular school. A lot of that has to do with this atmosphere of, you know, mutual violence toward each other's work and ambitions. And so he has sort of a philosophy that until you have vanquished all tyrants and until, you know, so many of the solvable problems of the world are solved, until you have, you know, addressed every despot and oppressor, until you've solved all of these plagues around the world, you can't attack a fellow artist. Like, there are much greater and more worthwhile enemies out there than your peer sitting next to you trying to paint pictures, you know. And yet, in so many environments, you do find that people that should be allies are fighting each other instead of fighting, you know, a common, much more dangerous enemy out there. And so he's very frustrated seeing these 19 and 20-year-old painters attack each other, which just seems like the worst misdirection of energy you could possibly have. And, you know, some early readers of the book who also went to art school, they were just, you know, they would call me immediately and be like, this was exactly the experience that they had, which was thinking you're going to a haven of, you know, fellow travelers and that are going to, you know, it's going to be this wonderful atmosphere of just painting and art and music and happiness, because, you know, why go into art if you're not going to try to create beauty and enjoy beauty and support each other? But instead, too often, they would find this place of antipathy and misery because this atmosphere of sort of competition had been engendered and in a lot of cases supported by the professors and the structures of the school. And so I think there's a better way. And whenever you study the sort of the history of art in any form, you find these groups of artists that come up together, like the Impressionists, for example, that were all about mutual support. And they put on each other's shows and supported each other and propped each other up when there were hard times, and they were fiercely loyal to each other. And there's a reason why we've heard of all of the Impressionists, you know, this whole group of artists that, whereas so many others of their period have been forgotten or not remembered, I guess, as well. And it's because that they ascribed to, you know, a rising tide lifting all boats. And I love groups of artists that come up together in supportive communities where they, you know, they say, you know, I'll be there for you, you be there for me. And I think that if we champion each other, we might do a little better than if we're all alone or see this as some kind of competition. And so anyway, Carpenter tries to create another model outside of this, you know, the university. And he sets up his atelier in the prairie in the middle of a cornfield, basically. And that becomes a haven for cricket, too.
You're listening to Marginalia. We're speaking with author Dave Eggers about his novel, Contrapposto. Can you talk about the illustrations that are included in the book?
There's two sets. One is to show sort of the kind of academic figure drawing that Cricket would do. So those are credited to Cricket Dibb, our protagonist. And then in the back, I don't want anyone to jump to the back because it really should be a surprise. But in the back, there's another set of figure drawings. And those were all done actually by artists here in San Francisco. We gathered about 10 figure drawing experts, and but all amateur students, and had models pose. And I wanted to see 10 people's different takes on the same models. And it turned out beautifully. And so I think that, you know, figure drawing is not 100% a staple of art schools anymore. I think a lot of them still do it or require one or two units. But in any given city, there's people that are gathering and hiring models and drawing. And it's something that I still do here at the McSweeney's offices. We hire a model from time to time, and anybody that wants to come, you know, from our staff and some friends will draw from the live model. And it's so, I don't want to use words like healing and meditative, but I will use these words anyway. It's healing and meditative to sort of sit and try to get a likeness or get the figure right, or at least just sort of like mimic that energy and put some lines down. And in our case, we actually talk to, it's a pretty small room that we all draw in. And so the model's right there chatting you up the whole time, even while they're doing these very interesting poses, usually nude. And but you're chatting about life and their background. And those that pose for life drawing classes are almost always some of the most interesting people in your town. And so they have 1,000 stories. So in a couple hours, you hear a couple dozen of those stories while you're drawing. And you just feel, I don't know why it works so well, but it's so affirming in a way. And I recommend it to anybody, whether you think you can draw or not. It's a really kind of a great experience to do, you know, once a month or so, or a couple times a year, no matter where you come from. I recommend it. And it's infinitely less provocative than you think it is. Like, everybody might be put off by the nudeness. Like, the nudeness lasts about 30 seconds, and then you forget that this person's nude. It's just sort of a set of shapes and lines, and then you get to work to try to make something interesting out of it on the page.
Something that captured my attention as I was reading were names. I mean, we know our main characters as Rob, Robert, Cricket, or R. Silas, or Pia, Olympia, Limpy, Ollie, Lim. And some of these names were chosen by their owners, and some were given by acquaintances. Is there power in choosing and in giving a name?
For sure. I think, you know, in Cricket's case, his given name is Robert, and then Silas is his grandfather's name too. And he's very close. His grandfather is the main male figure in his early life, but his mother has taken up with a guy named Robert, who's not quite a stepdad yet, but lives in the house a lot of the time, and they don't get along. And so, yeah, he chooses early on to go by his grandfather's nickname for him, which is Cricket. I don't have this experience myself. I was named Dave, and David never loved this name or my last name. They're not pretty or really different or interesting. And so I always struggled with it, because I was like, boy, it would be so fun to have a name that you gave yourself and something that is more in keeping with how you perceive yourself. And so I do always admire the people that at whatever stage in life take it upon themselves to rename themselves if they so choose. And Olympia, being a little bit more mercurial and a little bit more chameleon-like, has many names throughout the book, whereas Cricket, after, you know, the first chapter, has the one name. But, you know, at a critical moment when she's trying to help him in his career, she sort of renames him, thinking Cricket sounds too folksy and unserious to be a painter of paintings with high price tag on them. So she renames him R. Silas Bibb, which is it's definitely an Olympia thing to do. And she, of course, didn't ask him before she renamed him. And so he comes upon this name on a postcard with his work on the other side. And she, as always, thinks she knows better for him than how to help him than he can help himself.
You know, you said that these characters were in your brain, this idea, the story was in your head for 20 years. Are the characters still there, or have they moved on?
Oh, no. You know, these are two of my favorite people, period. They're really dear to me, and you know, there's a personal book in a lot of ways, and so they'll always be with me. And there's a few things that I know about that, you know, I went to art school for a half a minute and learned some techniques as a kid, but the rest of it is made up. And in a way, because when I was really young, I saw myself as I thought I would be a cartoonist or painter or something. And these are things that I still do from time to time. And so there's parts of the book that are kind of speculative in terms of, if I had gone that way or pursued that throughout my life, are these possible outcomes? And so some of the book is sort of exploring how would I have reacted to this? But then again, cricket is, I'm sitting here in the basement of McSweeney's. We have a printmaking shop, and I'm looking at a bunch of prints we made yesterday. We pay the rent on the building by selling these prints, and they're like $90 each. And so cricket is really uncomfortable with the commercial side of making art. I'm quite comfortable with making a print and selling it the next day to pay the rent on the building. And so for me, it's only been practical, really. And me as, you know, maybe the last 15, 20 years when I've been showing work and selling it. So I liked exploring what would it be like if he were just this stubborn, maybe even immature about his work. He has sort of a less developed idea of it, or maybe just stubborn to a fault. Whereas for me, maybe because it's a side hustle for me, I get to sort of enjoy it in its purest sense. I don't have to struggle with any kind of angst about creating drawings or prints, to me, it's just absolute joy from beginning to end, and there's never really been a struggle. But for cricket, anytime he gets close to actually, I guess, making a living doing it, he self-destructs or self-sabotages, I guess, because he just can't deal with even the slightest compromise. So I think we all know those people or encountered them or imagined them, that, you know, the purest of the purists. And but at the same time, I don't think he's ever upset by what he misses out on. And I loved kind of having him be kind of unbothered by what he isn't doing. And whereas it drives Olympia a little bit crazy to see what she sees as a lot of talent going to waste. But I've always wanted to write about friendships over time. And to me, that was the most fun part about it, is just to meet these two over 70 years in different places and put them in drastically different locations each time and at different stages of their life, and then let it rip. To me, it was the most fun I've had writing in a long time, and it came out. It's never effortless, but some books come out a little bit more fluidly, let's say.
Well, the book is Contrapposto. Dave Eggers, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Beth. Great to talk to you.
Contrapposto by Dave Eggers was published by Knopf. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Lou Ann Stevens. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
Each story you hear on Planet Money starts with a question. What happens if we refund tariffs? Why are groceries so expensive? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious, because the forces shaping our world can be hard to see. Follow NPR's Planet Money wherever you get your podcasts and start seeing how the economy really works.